Welcome to this afternoon's Digital Classicist Seminar. Thanks to our sponsor, the Institute of Classical Studies, for paying for this. This afternoon's seminar is Elton Barker and Leafy Saxon from respectively the Open University and Southampton, who are going to be mine the gap, finding ancient places in the Google Books corpus.
Many thanks, Stuart. Many thanks, Gabby. Many thanks to you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here again. I was here 2 years ago when I was supposedly co-presenting with Leaf, and that time he didn't turn up. He decided to go on holiday somewhere in Scotland and left me carrying the can. So I'm really happy that this time he's with me so he can answer all your questions.
You'll still be carrying the can maybe over time.
So I think a couple of things just to mention to begin with would be talking about many people, many projects as we go through this, because as you'll soon find out, it's not all about us. And I think it's very important in the kind of spirit of openness that I think characterizes digital humanities that these other people and these other projects get a mention, because certainly our work is building very much upon theirs. And I think that this kind of spirit of openness and collaboration is what makes this particular field so exciting. And as a classicist, and someone who works with texts all the time and did a traditional kind of PhD working by myself in a library surrounded by books, it's been a great pleasure to be meeting so many people and collaborating with so many people, and most of all, significantly Leaf. So it's a wonderful opportunity again to kind of show my enthusiasm for this kind of line of work. First up, though, is really giving you a background to the project.
Do you want to mention Kate and Eric?
I was going to mention Kate and Eric as we bring up some projects. So we'll get round to who we're working with as and when it becomes important, and this will come up in this first slide too. So where does GAP come from? It comes from two projects approaching a similar problem from different perspectives. They are respectively Hestia and Open Context. Hestia was a project that I was principal investigator of. It was funded by the HRC, and that was actually the project that I spoke about last time here. And it was, the main point of it was exploring spatial concepts in the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. One element of which was using the digital text of Herodotus we got from Perseus to see if we can flag up interesting patterns and use web mapping technologies to think about space differently. And Leaf was my IT consultant on the project, because at the time, perhaps still is, working on his PhD, so he couldn't be co-investigator of that project, and besides he was charging too much. So we only had him as a IT consultant. But even then, I was really intrigued by the possibilities of the digital component for exploring a particular text. So we were investigating ancient places in a narrative. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, running out of UC Berkeley, Eric Kanzer, whose name you saw in that first slide as part of GAP, had instituted this website called Open Context, which is about finding books from place references. So it's an archaeological site that people contribute to, and it's all about going to try to find textual material related to those places. So you can see that both projects were using, kind of experimenting with web technologies for mapping between places and texts, and for exploring the dynamic between chronological time and narrative flow. But the missing factor here for both projects was scale. Hestia was, we got this digital text from Perseus, but the Perseus text that we got was semi-automated, and it required a great deal of hand correction to make sure that all the places mentioned in the text were could be verified. Whereas Open Context problem was that it was relying upon data that other people were contributing voluntarily. So we needed to find ways of supersizing this process. Anything to add so far?
I think the title of this slide, It's Not About the Map, is also flags up an interesting issue here, which is that I think often when people are presenting, this is one of the challenges that we face when presenting this work, which is that we tend to show a lot of web maps, and the result is that people think, oh right, great, so you're doing web mapping then. And that's actually not very much what our intention is. What we're really interested in is the relationship between place and document. So we're not I mean, we have side interests in the relationship between places, and we also have interest in the relationship between documents. But we think it's by looking at those references, those intersections between concepts on the one hand and documents on the other, that really exciting things can come out. So we can start looking at the clustering, both in terms of spatial stuff and in terms of the documents themselves. And we'll come back to those particular points. But what we wanted to emphasize is it's not just about finding out coordinates and sticking them on a web map. I think that's crucial. It's the ideas of the places that we're excited about.
Yeah, in many ways, getting beyond the spatial coordinates and thinking about what space might mean for different peoples at different times, particularly narrativized space. That's what interested us and wired us in many ways, even though we're, as you'll see, supervising the process, we're still interested in how space is narrativized. And if we can try to leverage the modern technology to help us to do that, you know, that's really what we're about. So, on the subject of supersizing,
we'll have to go forwards. No.
Technology.
There we go.
There we go. Enter Google. So, as you well know, Google are supersizing everything. They had this amazing corpus of books, Google Books corpus, 12 million books in so many hundred languages. And, you know, many of these texts previously only available in prestigious libraries, so a huge opportunity for people to get to familiarize themselves with, get to grips with stuff that very few people had seen before. But they wanted people to use this. They, I think, saw it as a problem that, you know, they come and digitize all these books, no one's going to use it, you know, kind of what's the point? So they had a scheme started last year called the Google Digital Humanity. Oh, hang on, what was it? The Humanities.
Google Digital Humanities Awards.
There you go. And we were, Eric Leaf and myself submitted a proposal, and we were fortunate enough to get a little bit of money from them to play around with Google Books Corpus. And really, we had two central questions, really, and that they were, okay, we've got all of these books, but how can you discover interesting information about what's out there, and then how can you make use of it? And for both of us, coming from Hestia and Open Context, we were focusing on the central question of ancient places. So can we find a way of discovering ancient places in an automated way across the Google Books corpus, not just in one text, Herodotus' history, but across the whole corpus? And then once we've discovered these places, well, what can you do with them? Can we visualize them in a particular way so other people can come along and make use of them? So these were the two central questions that have been driving our research so far.
It's also worth just reflecting on that as well, in terms of working with corporations. There was an interesting post on Humanist a couple of days ago that I responded to, with that somebody was asking about whether it was a role of the digital humanities to, as it were, encourage democratization, in inverted commas, within the digital humanities, whatsoever, you know, that might mean. And I think it's a very important question for those of people who are working specifically with the web. I would argue, I wouldn't want to put words in the mouth of my colleagues, but I would argue that if we are working with the web, that actually is a fundamental role of what you're doing, because the web is about scale and it's about access. Those are the things that the web does remarkably well. But that in turn raises some interesting questions as to what level that dynamic, that democratizing process, should be driven by the corporations, and what degree it should be driven by the academy. I certainly think that it's inappropriate for the academy to claim that the corporations should not be driving, you know, so effectively protest at the corporations driving this process because they feel unable to do it themselves. I think, you know, the academy needs to be effectively take part in that process and really reevaluate how much we do that already. To what degree we're doing that in hand in hand with the corporations is, of course, a really interesting question. But certainly our relationship with Google has been. I mean, they've been very
hands off.
They've been very hands off, and they've also been extremely willing. All our data, for example, that we produce is CC0, and they've been. We put it directly into the public domain, and they have absolutely no objection to us doing that. Of course, we're not taking their data and putting that in the public domain, which needs to be made clear. But they haven't you know, been attempting, as it were, to generate stuff out of the academy which they're privately leveraging for their own benefit.
Yeah, and I guess inevitably I'm going to support Leaf on this. I think the point being that it's an opportunity for us to shape the field. And to give them credit, I think also Google realizes themselves that humanities scholars and the kind of research that we do, the research questions we ask, are interesting. And they're not typically the kind of questions that they will necessarily have thought about or computer scientists will think about. So it's a real opportunity for us to get involved and to shape things how we want search engines to operate, etc. And I know that other projects, digital projects around the country and around the world, are very much interested in trying to go beyond a Google search engine and think of a search engine that's going to be much more tuned to the kind of research that we do. Now, this side, there and back again, as well as being a reference to fantastic work of literature, of course, reminding that there are these texts out there. This is all about getting there, so empowering users to find out about ancient places in this massive text corpora. And of course, what we should be saying here is that we're not aiming for complete coverage, but rather facilitating access and discovery through automated means. It's not just about getting there, however, it's also getting back again. So it's not enough to find the places, as I've mentioned before, you've got to do something with them. So here it's about generating the places and the books that refer to ancient places, again in a fully automated way, again using technologies, web technologies that are free and open. So what we're going to do for the rest of the talk is to kind of show you, this is a work in progress seminar after all, we're going to show you whereabouts we are in this work so far. So we'll be sketching out the gap approach to discovering places, and we'll be highlighting two processes. So and this again will be an opportunity for us to mention friends, colleagues and other projects upon which our work is building. So we'll be talking about how we've tagged references to ancient places in text and resolved them to a gazetteer, and this will involve talking about the Edinburgh Geoparser and the fourth member of the GAP team, Kate Byrne from the Institute of Informatics in Edinburgh. Second basic project on which we're founding our work is Pleiades. So we'll be talking about how we've identified these ancient places using uniform resource identifiers that we've got from Pleiades. And not just using Pleiades, but also updating their gazetteer as well. So you can start seeing the kind of the self, the mutual improvement between these different projects. So that's going to be the next couple of slides. Then the last few slides will be looking at the kinds of trial visualizations and usages that we are leveraging on the data. So we'll be talking about narrative maps of ancient places in Google Books, and we'll also be talking about how we can start linking to other resources. And there'll be a couple of other projects we want to mention at the end about where this kind of work might be going into in the future. There are three points we're both, I think, very keen to mention at the onset. First of all, this is very much a proof of concept. This work is really about establishing a pipeline for accessing and using vast text corpora in useful and meaningful ways. Now, we're testing on the Google Books corpus because we've been given this opportunity by Google to do this, but what we'll be doing is applicable to other text corpora. And in fact, I think we have an example even drawn from the Open Books Archive, is that right?
I think it's the Internet Archive.
I remember. So you can see this isn't going to be specifically just for Google Books, but it'll be more generally for large text corpora. And related to that is this idea that it's whatever we're producing is open to use, reuse by everybody else. That is the data, that is the resources, and everything that we're doing is being documented online. I like to think in a free and open way, and you're very welcome to leave your comments free and openly as well, and we really do encourage you to do that. Second point is that we're standing on the shoulders of the giants here. GAP is leveraging the data, tools and resources that are already out there. We're not claiming that we're coming up with anything unique here, it's rather the application, and really the idea that we're now in the kind of the second generation of I should have a second generation Star Trek t-shirt on, shouldn't I really? It's because a lot of stuff has been digitized, and it's about making use of the material that has been digitized. to kind of shift from digitizing to repurposing. And I think that's really where the exciting thing, that this is really where it's at now, because that I think is when we start attracting the attention of humanists and scholars, you know, traditional scholars, because it'll be showing, I think, new ways of thinking about particular texts, particular new research questions will come up, I think, because of the potential of its medium. And thirdly, our project, and one which we'll mention at the end, is all about linking data. And it's about tying the web and this manifold, you know, this very varied bunch of resources together. And Leif has come up with a new metaphor for us today, which is GAP is the gaffer tape of digital humanities. So, anything you'd like to say before we get stuck in?
No, other than I think to agree that I think it's varied over the across the digital humanities. I think different parts, you know, different areas of the digital humanities are perhaps at somewhat different stages, and certainly the fact that we have move to a level of maturity, I think, in the digital classics where it is now possible to start tying together data and methods and tools and so on in a way that where historically we've more or less always had to kind of build from the ground up and say, okay, first of all, I have to create a data set and then frequently build tools to work with it and so on. That there are now windows of opportunity for people to take these things together and merge them together in new ways, apply tools which were historically applied to or have, not historically, but have been applied to one data set and start reapplying them to new ones and rethinking that process. But that, of course, isn't to say either that there isn't a huge deal of value continuously being created by people who are creating new tools or developing them, creating new and improving data sets. But it is a very, very exciting time to be working in the classics, I think, in particular, because that material is available in a way that even 2-3 years ago, I think, was still difficult. And I might say that as well, there's an interesting contrast with archaeology, where I feel that, you know, there are open data sets available in archaeology. It's still very much the exception rather than the rule, and it would be terrific to see a great deal more movement happening in that field.
Right, the biggest challenge was, okay, with the Herodotus text we got from Perseus, that had been TEI encoded, now semi-automatically, so like I said, we had to go through the text and make certain corrections, edits, etc. But because it's TEI encoded, the place names could be easily gathered together, captured, put into a database, start doing interesting things with. Well, what do you do with the Google Books corpus, which is unstructured and a bit of a mess? I think I can say that. Well,
you wouldn't be that.
Well, we obviously needed to find a way of trying to find, discover these ancient places without any of this structural markup. And I think, Leif, you had an anecdote that you about how you came across the Geoparser.
I was presenting. We had just received our grant money and. We as part of that, I think we thought through all sorts of exciting and interesting ways that we could improve the sort of geo-parsing process and create this. And I was looking forward to presenting them at a workshop that I was at with Stuart in Nottingham a little over a year ago. And immediately prior to my presentation, Claire Grover from the University of Edinburgh gave her presentation, where she talked about all the amazing things that they had already done, at which point I rapidly had to start rewriting my presentation and introduce myself to Claire. I think this is a perfect example of where we saw there are people, there is fantastic prior art here, there are people doing some really great stuff. However, of course, the Edinburgh Geoparser has historically been, or has up until that point, been using geonames and other gazetteers as the basis for the geoparsing. So we were interested in taking, if you like, that functionality and working together with them in taking that functionality, but using an entirely different gazetteer, which, of course, for them was then, was an interesting new research problem.
So they're basically working with data sets that are contemporary. Yep. And we were saying, okay, can you work with us to look at, you know, data sets that are distinctly not contemporary, but, you know, ancient material?
Although, of course, they are also working with the Challenge Project with Stuart for sort of historic, but again, but not in terms of, you know, thousands of years, hundreds of years.
The GeoPass, I guess, is a two-step process. You have the geotagging, which you kind of got the you call through the text, tokenizing it, identifying the places. And then you've got the georesolution, where you move from the text to the gazetteer.
Yeah. In both cases, as you were saying, we need a you need a meaningful gazetteer. You need a meaningful gazetteer, first of all, to figure out, in the case of geotagging, in the geotagging process, you need, when you're looking for the tokens, well, those tokens are the things you're going to find in the gazetteer. But in terms of the georesolution, which is the process of figuring out, okay, I know that this is probably a reference to a place, but there are several aphrodisiases, or there are several Nicopolises, or whatever it happens to be, then how do you figure that out? And the way that the geoparser works, which fortunately was something that we've been hoping to build ourselves and does a lot better, I'm sure, than anything we would have cooked up, is by using coordinates which are associated with those places, and essentially using this kind of intuitive notion that where you get textual clustering, or effectively where you get a whole bunch of places consistently referred to together within a text or within a chapter of a text, then what you tend to find is that there is a geographic clustering of those places as well. So an author will occasionally, but rarely, jump wildly around the place. Typically speaking, if they're talking about Athens, and they're talking about Corinth, and they're talking about Aegina, there is a reasonable chance that, because those are quite close together in Greece, you're more likely to talk about those ones than, say, Athens in Georgia and Corinth in Texas and Aegina. I don't know that there is even an Aegina in the United States. So it's using that assumption that where you see textual clustering, there is often geospatial clustering, geographic clustering as well, is one of the key notions about making that identification process.
As Leif has already flagged up, though, we needed a gazetteer here. We wouldn't be able to use geonames, because geonames generally deals with contemporary place names. We'll come back to geonames in a second, but for example, the idea of Athens would be vastly complicated if we're using geonames, because we'd be constantly being brought to Athens, Georgia. So, where do you go for an ancient gazetteer? Well, as many of you will know, there's this project running out of the Institute to Study the Ancient World at NYU called Pleiades, which is, I think, initially started as a digitization project of the Barrington Atlas, which was the authoritative classical atlas that only came out, I think, a decade or so ago. And the guys there have been since digitizing it. I think one key aspect of what Pleiades have done, something that I've learnt as a kind of non-techie person, just how important this is to assign uniform resource identifiers to places. So this means that even if you have a place but you don't know the location, that's okay, because you can give it a number, a kind of unique number. So that if you find information later about that place, it can give you a location and geographic coordinates. You can then subsequently add that information. But the important thing here is that each particular place, whether it's Alexandria in Egypt or Alexandria somewhere else, these Alexandrias can be differentiated according to the URI that Pleiades has given it. So this became our gazetteer.
Yes.
Can I explain some of the issues with using the Pleiades gazetteer?
Absolutely. I mean, other than also to add that it's hard to overemphasize just what an important resource Pleiades has become. Obviously, most of you here in the digital classicist will be aware of their work. They have presented here in the past. One of the exciting things I think is that actually right from the beginning, they got the importance of having URI. So it was the great thing was, even before there were coordinates available, they put URIs available that meant it was possible to map to. In fact, we started mapping to the Pleiades gazetteer prior to there being coordinates assigned to them, because the beauty being that we knew that they were going to come down the pipeline, and indeed they have come down the pipeline, and now we can use those coordinates. But also because it means that other groups can do the same kind of work, and we'll refer to this later on when we're talking about the Pelagios project. And again, we have that kind of that common reference across the web of gluing things together. So it really, we really could never have done this kind of work without Pleiades, and they really are pioneers, I think, within the kind of classics world. But of course, nothing is perfect. You can't have everything that you want. So there is an interesting issue. So currently, the great thing about Pleiades is that the URI is the primitive concept to which you can attach any number of additional pieces of information. So you can attach coordinates, you can attach alternative coordinates, you can attach polygons if you wanted, or other kinds of spatial features. You can attach toponyms, you can attach alternative toponyms. You know, essentially, there is no limit to the amount of information you can attach to this sort of opaque identifier that refers to the place. And that's very exciting. However, because of the historic basis from which they're working, it was the case that although there is the potential to attach lots of toponyms to these places, in practice, most of the times they only have one or two toponyms associated with that. And if you're in the process of geoparsing, what you really want is all of the possible, you know, as big and rich a possible list as you can get when you're looking for places. So because the drag is that if you have, for example, Rome, and you know that Rome is a toponym, but actually the word Roma happens to be used within your particular text, and you don't have that word set in your gazetteer somewhere, then clearly you're not going to even identify it in the first place, you're not going to tag it in the first place, let alone be able to identify it. So you really want to enrich that process. And we wondered how we might do that. But unfortunately, there was a very nice meshing, because there is another gazetteer that I think has been just as pioneering, but in a more contemporary level that we've already referred to, which is GeoNames, the GeoNames service. GeoNames, again, gives coordinates, but it has, although it predominantly, though not entirely, uses contemporary names, but it tends to have a very rich list of alternative toponyms in a vast variety of different languages. So in the case of London, then we'll also have Londres and Londinium and so on and so forth. Because they had coordinates, and because Pleiades itself had at that time bounding boxes, which they knew that these locations were in, essentially what we were able to do was do a match-up between GeoNames and Pleiades, which we call Pleiades Plus, whereby effectively we said, if there is a location in GeoNames, and one of its particular toponyms matches the toponym that's in Pleiades, or potential toponyms, but for the most part, the toponym in Pleiades, and the coordinates and GeoNames fall within the bounding box that Pleiades gives us, then we think it's a fairly likely match, in which case we will then add all of the toponyms which GeoNames associates with that particular identifier and keep those as a separate list. It's clearly not perfect as a solution. Clearly we didn't get absolutely all of them. And almost certainly we will have got you know, a handful of not so great ones, but we've kept them independent, and it's unquestionably massively helped in terms of it greatly helped in terms of that geotagging process initial.
Can you remember how much we've expanded the Pleiades gazetteer?
I think we expanded it by about 50%. I think in terms of, obviously, so not in terms of places, the number of, so all of Pleiades Plus always refers back to a Pleiades URI, right? So we're not, there are no new places introduced by this process, but in terms of the toponyms which are referred to, I think it increased by about 50%.
Which is, of course, exactly what we wanted, because as Leif was saying, when you're trawling through the text with the geoparser, you need to know these other toponyms, other geoparsers is not going to recognize them as the token it's, you know, it's looking for.
Yep.
So this just gives you an example of some of the other ones we've done. Aegyptus was a good one too.
Yeah.
Because we found that Pleiades didn't have Aegyptus, they had Aegyptios or something.
I think, yes, absolutely. And I think there was also an issue with...
Egypt, but when you're dealing with Herodotus, big problem if it's not coming up.
Yes, that was an issue. So what we've done, so this is a data set, which is again available CC0 from the Google Ancient Places site. And what's been great for us, actually been kind of very satisfying, is that obviously kind of it's been helpful for Pleiades, and Pleiades have been able to take that and start reworking, like it gives them a really interesting raw data set with which to start updating their own data, which is good. But later on, it also means that we can use it in the reverse direction, so that when we've identified Pleiades places, then we can also, on that basis, now begin to say, oh, well, by the way, we also happen to know this place. This is the GeoNames identifier for it, and GeoNames has lots of references to other things, like the Wikipedia article for it, or the DBP, DBPD URIs and so on. So we can kind of traverse it back in the opposite direction and also start extracting additional information from the web, some of which you may want, some of which you may not want.
It's again putting stuff together, really kind of disparate data sets all around the web, starting to pull them together so that users in particular can go off and find additional information that they might be interested in.
Yeah. I think in terms of the identification and in reference to a question, and I know I'm going to hedge this slightly to answer of a question that Stuart asked earlier on about how we deal with synonym, how do we deal with false positives and so on. We also have a method, I think, which we've dubbed Pleiades++, which is slightly confusing because Pleiades++ is actually more of a method than a data set. But essentially what we do is we start fairly strictly by searching over probable Pleiades matches and see if we can find something there, and if that's great, then if so, that's great. If we don't find anything, if we come up cold, this is the identification process, then we search geonames, I believe. I think we'd need to consult the details.
We consult geonames.
Yeah. We can consult geonames, and then we see if we can kind of work our way back. So essentially, we start with so start strict, and if that works, that's great. And if it doesn't work, then we expand. And that tends to give us a reasonably medium balance between having too much garbage on the one hand and too few and too limited results on the other.
So in other words, whenever you go, you never go to Pleiades Plus and geonames for something that Pleiades has already identified safely for.
I think so. Yes, exactly. I think yeah. So if we can do it straight with Pleiades, that's great. It might be that we use Pleiades Plus as from the outset, but we definitely. But if that doesn't work, then we'll often start and see if we can find something in geonames and then look for potential matches that way.
I think Gabby's just started a good principle here, which is that Leif and I have been talking for too long already. So this is a test for you guys. These are some results for a kind of a snapshot picture of places captured from certain texts dealing with the ancient world.
They are all histories, okay, so yeah. We'll give you that clue. They're all classical histories.
Can you identify... It's not going to be much good for you guys at home on listening to the podcast, but for those in the room, can you identify... And it's not good radio. Can you identify what's what? What historical narratives are being shown here?
Top left.
Top left possibly will be Tacitus.
Good. Tacitus there. Any other takers here?
Don't be shy. You're all classicists.
Josephus.
Remember Josephus? Any votes for Tacitus, Josephus? Josephus. Absolutely, yes. Well spotted there. So the Jewish wars there, with an obvious kind of emphasis there on the Levant and the Holy Land.
Top right.
One particular city seems to be getting a lot of attention there.
Oh, don't give them clues.
We've got Suetonius. Suetonius is a fair bit. Anybody else? Any other possibilities?
Any other histories?
Yeah. Well spotted.
Bottom left.
It's not Herodotus. It's not Herodotus. That would be too easy. Xenophon? Anybody else?
Close. In between Herodotus and Xenophon.
Yeah,
there you go, Thucydides.
Yeah. How about the last one there?
Yeah, the last one's a bit tricky. The fly in the ointment, shall we say. Don't necessarily think ancient.
Yeah.
Remember, we're using the Google Books corpus. It says up to 1900. So you pass. You are all classicists. Yeah. That's a relief, and it kind of shows that it's kind of okay. You get it. These are the results you'd expect.
Yeah.
And of course, we're not claiming that we've captured all the places by any means, but
all the places that we captured are always correct.
Yeah.
That's also.
But you do get a sense that this is. I mean, this has all been done automatically across. These texts. So this is kind of what we're looking for. So it's not bad, I think, as a result. But of course, that's just a little bit of fun, and that just gives you a sense of kind of the overall picture. But what we were talking about before, remember, was this idea of reading between text and place. That for us is absolutely the key, I guess, research that I think that this kind of technology can help us approach, and it kind of would hopefully raise new questions. So this brings us to this slide, where I think we can probably just try and talk you through it. What we're using here is a kind of time, let me get this right, it's timeline technology, that's right, that we had previously used on Hestia. The person who developed this timeline technology is a guy called Nick Rabinowitz. And for Hestia, he constructed this, basically this format that you see here. So you've got the text in the top right reading pane. You've got the Google Maps, which is your main kind of reading pane. And at the bottom, you've got what was a timeline, but in this kind of technology, I think we're calling a kind of time map.
It's a narrative, yeah.
Kind of a narrative map.
Yeah.
And so the principle, which is again with the same with was with Hestia, as you move through the text, whether through the reading pane here or through the narrative line at the bottom, so the places that get mentioned in the text at the bottom here come up. So basically this is you can start reading the text in relation, or start reading the map in relation to the text, and vice versa. We'd done this originally with Hestia, with, you know, one text, with Herodotus. Now this has been rolled out again to the, you know, to the Google Books corpus. So again, this is fully automated.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning. So for example, here we've got book equals, you know, in our cheesy way identifier here, Google Book 3. But essentially, that's a parameter for the data. So the actual, you know, this is just a generic front end. All the data itself is just stored as JSON files, and the reference to the image is directly back to Google itself. So again, we don't need to store all of that stuff. So I wouldn't say it's highly lightweight. The JSON data files themselves can get a little bit bulky, but it is essentially kind of raw textual data.
So what you've got here with this right hand column, whereas with, you know, the Hestia that had been kind of like I said hand encoded in a way, now that's just, you know, takes you straight into the Google Book that's part of the corpus. And if you click on any of the points, you come up with a little text box that gives you the kind of the surrounding text that mentions a particular place. It gives you a little bit of context as well. The other, I think, really important thing to mention here is that under the identification of the place, Argos, you've got a link to Pleiades. So this is where what we've also been talking about and emphasizing a lot of the time is kind of this linked data aspect. You can click on that link to Pleiades, and suddenly you're in kind of a different environment, and you can find out more information about that particular place.
It's also worth mentioning that this is actually a relatively early hack together that we did as a team, but Nick Rabinowitz is actually just about to start working with us in kind of vamping this up into to add in some additional functionality as well. So, you know, things like kind of color coding the icons themselves, so that they might represent, for example, how many times the place is referred to within the entire text, so that you have an indication not just that it's being mentioned now, but perhaps how important it is within the scope of the whole thing, and a variety of other little kind of bits and pieces. Also, potentially the ability for people to say this is just in the wrong place. You know, send us an automated email that says this, you know, you need to fix this. Getting that kind of, I think crowdsourcing would be too grand a name for it, but that indication that this is automated data and it needs eyeballs, and those eyeballs, you know, the eyeballs are the only way that it over
time. Our eyeballs aren't enough, so we could really use the help of others. But talking about, you know, the kind of new information you can get. This is a place called Cyzicus. I have no idea where that is.
No.
Anyway, this is what you're seeing here is what Leif, who's kind of king of puns, has termed placebook, so that you can see. Oh, it's terrible, isn't it? So what you see here is you'd click through to Cyzicus, and then you've got all of this information taking you back to the text. Remember that both going there business, but also the return home, the coming back. So we go out to the place Cyzicus, and then you've got all these particular links taking you to where Cyzicus is mentioned. in other sources.
What's also really nice, I think, is a good example here is that this here is hosted by an open context. So this is bringing in as well material culture. And I think this is where we think this starts to get really, really exciting, is that you're not just saying, you know,
these are coins.
It's all about classics, you know, whatever else. The point is we can start working together with different resource providers and saying, you know, we're interested in the books that talks about it, we're interested in the material that we might be able to kind of find there.
And some other stuff that we've been experimenting with. So as part of Hestia, we were really interested in the connections that Herodotus was making between places. And for that, we were using GIS. And I found GIS pretty difficult to use, not being particularly technically minded. And so Leif will back me up on this. I was constantly bugging him, you know, what was that query again, and what file was I supposed to have opened and stuff, and basically I was being quite pain in the ass for him. So fortunately, Eric from Open Context, part of GAP, has been experimenting with exploring the connections between places, kind of co-referentiality, using KML. So that kind of technology that we have in Google Earth, for example, this is stuff I can handle. You know, I can use Google Maps, I can use Google Earth. For me, this is scholarly functionality. Okay, so what you have here is this isn't meant to kind of demonstrate anything so much as be the giving you some information, kind of raising some interesting patterns that you can explore further. So what we have here are the connections that Byzantium has with other places in Herodotus. And you have all the places mentioned, you know, places nearby in the text at the bottom here. So you can start, you know, exploring the particular network connections, let's say, between places in the text. So this is really, with Google Books, of course, you're dealing with this massive text corpora. This is one example where you might want to, as a scholar, drill down into the data and look for some interesting patterns within one particular text, or indeed a series of texts.
One of the really interesting things I think this also illustrates here, although clearly you need, I mean, a single example that I don't think is enough to demonstrate that, and a lot more work needs to be done. But the thickness of the lines here, which are joining these places, are essentially based on the distance, or the textual the average texture of an index of the average token distance, if I recall, between the reference to the particular place, in this case Byzantium, and other places within that text. So effectively, it's the cluster, how much they cluster, which places are most commonly referred to in terms of distance to this particular place. And perhaps sort of unsurprisingly is that we have here, you know, Bosporus is the number one, followed by the Hellespont and Miletus and so on. And what you can see up here, I think, hopefully, is that we do see a level of that kind of that geographic clustering that you might expect. Okay, so the thick lines here, referring to the Bosporus and the Hellespont, given that this text is from, you know, the entirety of the of Herodotus' histories, a text that has a scope that runs from the pillars of Hercules, you know, all the way out to Bactria, that you can see that actually most of the places referred to in relation to Byzantium are relatively close together geographically. Clearly, that's a claim that one would have to unpack to a massively greater extent. We're not suggesting that Athens is only ever referred to in places.
Well, exactly. Well, what will be interesting, I think, the interesting patterns may emerge from that is the different places have that different degree of, power to attract.
Yeah.
So I'd imagine Athens would have a very different set of results.
Yeah.
Because of the prominence of Athens in the text.
Yeah.
This is the kind of thing that you can now start to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, exactly. And we said the data is there. We encourage people to look at these things.
We want to end with two kind of flash forwards where this is going.
Are we okay for time, by the way? Are we horribly over?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, great.
So, this is one. This is the Pelagios project, which actually some of you in the room are involved. So, if GAP is all about searching for ancient places within a narrative, Pelagios extends that concept of searching for ancient places, but takes it beyond just simply text and unstructured text to other kinds of data, you know, databases, maps, graphs, bringing in with it a whole lot of other information. So not just text, but also images, material, cultural evidence, you know, etc. we list the partners that are part of Pelagios. So there's Arachne, which is the German archaeological database. There's Klaros, which is the new database, kind of what would you call it?
Linked data overview of a whole series of other data projects
just
being
launched,
based at Oxford.
Yeah, just been launched from Oxford. There's DME, there's Digital Media Engineering, that I think specializes in mapping. There's us, of course. Lucero is an Open University project that's been looking at linked open data at the Open University. Nomisma deals with coins. Perseus, well, that deals with TAI, structured text. Ptolemy machine.
Absolutely. It's Neil Smith's project, which is putting essentially a TEI encoded version of Ptolemy's geography online.
And SPQR, which is KTL, which I think is epigraphic text, is that right?
It's epigraphy and papyri.
So basically, the idea behind Pelagios was to start drawing together these very these data sets that all had some kind of relationship and interest in ancient places, and get them to, I'm not sure if I've been using the right terminology here, but kind of expose their data in such a way that they can start linking with each other. So basically an ontological approach. Is that right?
A linked open data-y approach.
Okay,
yeah.
Linked open data-y approach. Thank you for that. And once we start doing that, then start to experiment with some of the things you can do. So what you have here is again that kind of Google Map image with a polygon. I think this is related to all the kind of data that's been found.
This is super new, by the way. We have to say this is was done by
like 2 days ago, or even yesterday.
And it's the very, very beginnings of an interface here. So we want to highlight that this is by no means even approaching.
These are so far the data groups have been good and handed in all their data. So I'm very glad to see the gaps there. Otherwise, I'd be kind of looking at you. So we've got GAP, we've got Ptolemy, we've got Perseus and Nomisma. And at the minute, they're not connected. All you've got is, you know, these data sets that have data that's related to this kind of polygon area that you see. But what will emerge from this is you won't just have connections between the various, internally within the various data sets, but you'll start getting connections across the data sets, the linked data thing. So that when you're looking at a text in GAP, you might want to find out the archaeological information related to those ancient places in that text. And you'll be able to click on a link and you'll go through to this other data set, and vice versa. So this is a world where we start hopefully exploiting much better the data that's out there. Like I said, you know, we're dealing with just textual corpora with GAP. Pelagios is extending that principle to all of these different data sets, so they'll all be possible to kind of hook up and find information about.
Yep, we should just say, so this is the beginnings, and again, just to acknowledge our friends and co-conspirators, so this is the work, Reiner Simon at the Austrian Institute of Technology and Digital Memory Engineering is working a lot of the kind of the visualization for this stuff, but we're very excited about the direction that it's going, but it is very, very early days at the minute.
And then finally, our work with GAP, and specifically the geoparser, this ability to trawl through a text, tagging the tokens, the places within the text, and then resolving to a gazetteer and being able to visualize that, that's attracted the attention of, what would you call Project Bamboo?
I think the project that needs no interruption.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you've all heard of them. My previous experience of them had been just hearing what other people were saying, and then it seeming that they were really interested in infrastructure, but it seemed to be, from what I was gathering, kind of top-down approach. Well, our relationship with them so far has been very good in the sense that what they seem to be interested in with GAP, at least, and specifically the geoparser, is a kind of bottom-up approach. They see that the geoparser has great potential, not just for trawling through ancient texts, but through any kind of corpora of texts. And so they're really interested in using the geoparser to be able to be basically a pipeline for other data sets for humanity scholars more generally, not just those who are dealing with classics. So they're very interested in kind of taking the geoparser and running with it, and then offering that as a service that other people kind of plug into.
Yeah, I think that's my understanding as well. We're in discussion with them exactly how that's going to work, but certainly, effectively, it's a way of kind of abstracting out many. So, you know, essentially, you know, we've taken data that's been, you know, that Google has provided, and we've been taking a gazetteer that Pleiades have provided, and we've been taking the tools that the Edinburgh Geoparty have provided, and we've been interfaces that we've developed and that Nick Rabinovitz has developed. So kind of returning to that notion that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, we're working with materials and with tools and with people who are already working in that space and collaborating with them. I think Bamboo are interested in kind of abstracting out that process so that it's easier, as it were, to fit in and to say, okay, well, let's try that same thing, but let's use books from the HathiTrust, or here is a different geoparser that uses a different algorithm. How do we get different? How does the output differ? And what happens when we can compare those things? What happens if we use the GeoNames gazetteer or something perhaps entirely different? Perhaps we take names from the LGPN, the lexicon of Greek personal names. Continuously thinking about different ways we might plug things in and try different combinations of those tools and those data, and essentially making it a much more rapid process to get to the point where we're asking humanities questions. I suppose I think that's what's so exciting, is that historically digital humanities projects, you're having to invest 60-70% of your time just in trying to get all your ducks in a row so that you can even begin to start thinking about the humanities questions. What will be really exciting is that, as clearly we'll never collapse that to zero, and clearly we'd never want to collapse that to zero, but the more we can make that process more efficient, then potentially the more rapidly, the more brain power we can expend on actually
doing interesting stuff.
Doing the interesting things that, the reason that we're humanists in the first place.
And with that, thank you. This is the blog site, so please do kind of check up what we're up to, and please do get involved. That goes with, I dare say, the questions you're going to level at us now. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very, very much to Ethan Alton. I'm going to invoke Chair's privilege and go first, because I have two questions. One very specific one a bit more general. GeoParser is available, as I understand it, freely through the Jisc Unlock text service. Are you going to be making your kind of Pleiades gazetteer available via Jisc Unlock?
So it depends what you mean by that. That's a quick question.
You can just plug multiple gazetteers. You can plug GeoNames or Ordnance Survey, and I think are the only two at the moment.
Yeah.
And then just say off you go. I mean, it would be great if I could just plug your gazetteer into the Unlock.
So in terms of gazetteers, that's effectively a conversation that would need to take place, I think, from the Pleiades perspective, between the Pleiades team, and the Edinburgh Geoparser team. I think they are already in touch. Certainly, we would greatly encourage that collaboration, and clearly, as far as the Pleiades Plus data goes, in terms of that mapping to GeoNames as well, then we're delighted to make that. We make it CC0 for the specific reason that it's great if people want to say thanks very much for this, but we would much rather that people just use it if they found it useful.
It's easy to do. And that actually leads to my other very quick question, which goes back to your point about you use the top and invariants of GeoNames and map those to the bounding boxes in Pleiades, which seems quite, if I got that right, so if a bounding box in Pleiades, if it contains the GeoNames coordinates, mm-hmm. associate the...
Yes, the Pleiades bounding box, the GeoNames coordinates, that's right.
That's very ingenious, but why couldn't you just have a kind of same as or similar to predicate between the GeoNames URI and the Pleiades URI? Wouldn't that be the same thing?
You're absolutely right. I think you potentially could do that. I think we just produced it simply as a CSV file. In effect, I mean, essentially, we could absolutely transform that. Yes, absolutely right. Into linked data, and we haven't done it as linked data. We've just done it as a CSV file. But there's no reason we shouldn't.
Okay. I will shut up and allow it to join
it. Anyway, thank you very much. It's really a fantastic presentation, and it seems as really some projects with the classics and archaeology would do. Obviously, you have a few problems there. And one of the first problems comes to mind is the distinguishing between names, persons' names, and places. I know you're using the GeoParser to parse them. I mean, what about linking names pass up, something like that. So actually, like the Hellenistic period, I mean, in other periods, sometimes Alexandria means some Alexandria Polis, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Or, but mm-hmm. in Hellenistic period, for instance, some areas like Perniki or Pernici would be, you can't really tell what is the name of a person, name of a princess from Syria, the Seleucus, who later married to what, Heros or something. And then what is actually a name place, which is actually currently now Benghazi, for instance, Arsinoe, which is Tokra, which is the name of princes. And all these names actually mentioned by Tacitus, and obviously you must have probably plotted them as a name on the map, because you're linking with Pleiades, and Pleiades recognized them as a name place. But actually, they are names of people mentioned in the context of names of people. This is obviously a big problem, because think you might need to identify these are possible names of people and possible names of places.
That's certainly the case when we were testing our methodology with Herodotus, because we had, if you like, a gold standard Herodotus,
yeah.
because we had the TI encoded and we'd gone for it by hand. We had a good grasp of the ancient places in Herodotus. So when we were developing precisely the use of the geoparser, we were using that Herodotus gold standard against which to judge the geoparser on the Google Books Herodotus, the kind of automated process. And the first thing that, one of the first things that Kate did
mm-hmm.
actually was to construct a list of personal names from Herodotus, because
yeah.
we were getting too much, you know, background noise. Too many people were getting drawn into the geoparser. For example, Priam. There's a Priam in the States somewhere. We had no idea about this. So, I think your question is a really good one for making the gazetteer more specifically oriented towards, and I think this is actually a more general point, the gazetteer being oriented towards a particular data set. And it's something that Kate was, one of the things that she really thought about at the beginning was the geoparser is only ever as good as the gazetteer that you have. And one way in which you can improve the gazetteer, of course, is having all the list of personal names that are going to, if you like, infect the gazetteer. I guess one thing I'd also say is that we are interested in extending this to people
mm-hmm.
with LGPN, so the lexicon
see,
of Greek personal names.
Mm-hmm.
So we're currently trying to find some way of collaborating with them so that we can then start, you know, looking at people in the same principle as being looking for places, and maybe even coming up with some interesting work on the relationship between people and places and time when particular names are in fashion, for example, something like this.
No, this is really good. And the other thing is, I think it's very good to use geonames, but I think you need to narrow it down a bit.
Yeah.
It's like sort of, I don't know how you narrow it down. But
well, it's precisely why we've been...
Yeah, the first thing that
yeah.
occurs to my mind is using sort of, is this name place categorized as a modern name
yeah.
or the ruins?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you could actually start with ruins, or you, if you have a wider choice, you say, no, narrow it down to the ruins. And then, so I think it's fantastic to use all the resources you have, whether geonames or Pleiades, and then pick up and choose whatever.
Yeah. We did also feel, I mean, we should say that when it came to genomes, we weren't just using the raw data. We were, we filtered out effectively, you know, hotels, you know, the hotel, right, you know, whatever it happens to be. We filtered out a bunch of stuff. And I think for the most part, we actually, once we filtered out most of the garbage, we weren't actually, I think, ever forced into situations where we needed to prioritize kind of heavily. I think we found that there weren't too many hits, or at least they were, you know, they were relatively close enough. So we were okay in terms of needing to say, is it a ruin or is it the, you know, the contemporary town within that bounding box coordinate intersection. I think it was usually, you know, a reasonable estimate. But yes, you're right. It's definitely an issue.
How you define ethnicity?
Yeah.
I mean, places basically, or areas. or, I mean, this is another area, because sometimes you talk about ethnicity that like the lotus eaters or something, mm-hmm. or whatever, and who live in that particular area of the world, and you could actually, the for instance, in Herodotus, he mentioned quite a lot the Libyan tribes, for instance, the Mishwas, mm-hmm. or Lib or whatever, and these are areas, and some of them they overlap, and some are around, move along, but they are important in many ways of defining places and ethnic people.
I think
this is another thing, but it is a complex issue.
I think we've been entirely in agreement with you about that, and it's one of the reasons that we're so enthusiastic, if you will, about the a Pleiades style systems. And whilst we wouldn't, again, we don't want to make claims that the Pleiades gazetteer can, does all this and more. The great thing is that you're not chained in the way that with a GIS you are to that conception of location. And I think that's often one of the big issues with ethnoi, is this sort of assumption of like, well, if we can't put a pin in a map, then we just simply have no way to refer to these things. This is not we feel very strongly that just because you can't do that, you should still be able to say this text is referring to this, ethnic, and that one is as well. And sure, we can't stick it on a map, but we can still find it through, Placebook or through hyperlinking.
So I have a follow-up question. So Pleiades have URIs for tribes as well.
I think they have some. I don't think I don't know how deep the coverage is. I wouldn't.
Again, this would be very interesting.
There's a lot in the Barrington Atlas.
So well, exactly. In the Barrington Atlas, that's right. Yeah.
This would be related to questions like, for example, Thucydides refers to the Athenians rather than the city of Athens. So you have presences of the Athenians at various points throughout the Peloponnesian War, for example, which isn't actually related to the place itself.
Yep.
Yeah, this came up with the Herodotus project, the Hestia project, where we not only were, like I said, using automated ways of investigating spatial data, but we had a very close textual analysis of one book, Book 5, and that was the first thing we noticed, that we weren't capturing not even 25% of the spatial data, because Herodotus was using the ethnic category so often, or indeed individuals as proxies. Now, when he says Darius is in Scythia, he doesn't imagine Darius the individual by himself in Scythia. He's talking about Persia or the Persians. So this is something that at the minute, at least, the automated way of looking for spatial data wasn't in a position to capture.
I think the other thing that it does bring up that's really important is that this is not automated processes are. I think we strongly believe that you can't work through very large corpora entirely by hand. I think that's probably fairly self-explanatory, or at least not many people would dispute that. On the other hand, I hope also most people would also not dispute is the fact that automated data is inherently untrustworthy, and that's an issue in its own right depending on what you're using it for. I think it's again an area that we're really keen to start pursuing, is finding more simpler and more intuitive ways for crowdsourcing this stuff micro crowdsourcing, if you like. So not trying to sort of sit down and coach people necessarily into doing a huge amount of work, so much as making it useful enough for them to want to use it, but then also making it really easy for them to say this is not as it should be, and potentially. Offering suggestions. The other thing I think it's fair to say is that our interest is quite heavily on sort of contextualization, visualization, and sort of structural level information, as opposed to minutiae and reasoning and logical deduction and this stuff. I personally am quite skeptical about the ability to do a lot of that stuff, particularly in the humanities context, where so much is vague or uncertain, and where chains of reasoning, chains of logic break down typically very rapidly. So where you have much shorter chains of inferencing by sort of saying, there's this document, it refers to this place, or this bunch of places, you can often kind of get a much better sort of structural feel and provide information which the user is free to interpret or make sense of as they
want. Question is about sort of that middle ground of where you have this kind of structural data, but then there's the more interpretive side, because you had said at the outset that this was not just about putting places on a map,
yeah.
that it was about concepts or notions of space and location, and this question of, you know, referring to place through an individual, you actually mean a collective or an institution, or the Egyptians refer to the Mesopotamia, the land where the river runs backwards, for example. So it's perspectival place is a term. So how do you, this is how, you know, those particular concepts of space and location are being built up. So how do you, without getting tied up into these chains of logic where they start to break down quite quickly, what sort of tools or ways can people start to take the data that's just on and out there and then start to extract some of this more contextual information about how people on the ground actually felt about being in those spaces, particular times or
situations? In a sense, and I mean, you might want to add stuff to here, I think we see it as trying to get people to the text as quickly as possible. So rather than, because I think fundamentally we don't believe that you can do that without actually, I mean, it's almost meaning, in a certain sense, you know, trying to abstract it out so much that you never have to read the book, you know, it's not our view. It's more about saying, you're interested, you know, in this place, well, here's a bunch of references, here's a probable bunch of references with the text immediately available that you can kind of make some sense of, and we're looking at ways to try and facilitate that process and make it certainly better than it is currently.
And not just textual data, of course, but all different kinds of data. That's where it gets, I think, very exciting. So that you really you're putting the power of analysis into people's hands, you know, to a much greater level than perhaps you can do just reading a text in a library, because you can have all of this data there that people can then go off and explore for themselves. But the fundamental thing is there's still the process of research, and I think having the data there, as Lee says, to provide a context, a broader, deeper context than perhaps we have achieved before, I think. There's the other important thing here, I think, is the ability to drill down into the data, so that that's in relation also to being able to maybe see patterns that you wouldn't have been able to see otherwise before using other forms of media. This is one, I think, great. Of course, it's also a danger. It's a very seductive danger, but the power of visualization. So. We showed you that network map. There might be, if you were to have a series of network maps, you'd be able to maybe get a sense of kind of that perspective that you were talking about, the different perspectives that you get in different narratives. And being with that being visualized, you'd be able to then, like I say, maybe find some interesting patterns and then go to the text. I don't think any of this can replace the textual analysis. We rather see it as a stimulus to it and providing the tools to maybe grapple with it in different ways that are going to be interesting.
Visualization is really, really interesting topic, but sometimes if you don't have it really correct, it will be misleading in many ways. So you really have to incorporate a reviewing procedure within it, or a cycle of reviewing procedure, in order to allow for correction of the information. And making visualization is as correct as possible, because you might have a sort of cluster of data in the wrong place, and then people will assume or interpret it or get the impression that is actually true. But unless you have a reviewing procedure, which people say, "I'm sorry, but this is have to be reviewed," or there's a problem with it. So. Unless you do that, you will always have some sort of problem later, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying being negative or anything, but what you're doing is really fantastic. So.
No, I mean, just to underline that point, I mean, I couldn't agree more. People often complain about, well, the technology, you know, is this kind of is the problem. You know, bad scholarship is what is bad scholarship. If you go into something blindly and wave your hands around and make some cool graphs and whatever else and call that research, well, you're not, you know, kidding anybody other than yourself. I mean, ultimately, you've got to do stuff, build a case, and frequently with lots of non-technical arguments as well. And I think this is, again, a mystique and too much expectation laid at the door of digital humanities, as though one day we were going to perform, you know, create the perfect graph that demonstrated this kind of wonderful, you know, research doesn't work in that way. That graph is just part of a bigger argument that you build.
It's part of the interpretive process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And in fact, but I just want to, before seeing what your question was, as a follow-up, if you remember, Leif, at the beginning of Hestia, when we had got together from the digital text to all the places, you were using visualization in GIS to find the anomalies.
Yeah, yeah.
And see, that was a really good way of flagging up to me that not only that there are problems in the digital text that we were getting, but also the methods you could use to improve it. Actually, so we ended up with a better text because of the visualization. Yes. Going, oh, that's really odd. Yes, is it odd or is it just wrong?
Which when you won't be able to spot it normally.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, move on to the next question.
Yes. I have two questions. First of all, it concerns the previous observation. Of course, it's probably extremely difficult to make the difference between to make the computer understand or the program understand what's the difference between BERNK and BERNK. What is the difference between Arsinoe and Arsinoe? What is the name? What is the place? But I think it's extremely important because if the gap is extremely small, I mean, if you can do it automatically, this will certainly spare the work, kind of slave work, of encoding, which is always a good thing. Context maybe a good thing. For example, something like when you have at for BERNK.
Absolutely.
Place.
Yeah.
Context and I think it's a very very important thing. And personally, for example, I've tried a lot of information, for example, from a colleague's speech made me think that he's 90%, there are 90% chances that he's Libyan or has a connection with Libya. I don't know if it's true. So this kind of thing is probably important. And secondly, a question. It's wonderful what I found in Geonames.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, I work, as you know, on the Manapilan project, which is based, the subject is Turkey and Central Anatolia. And the big problem is the identification of the Turkish names. For some places where the name changed, at least in 1900, five names for the same village. Is this something that the artist takes into account? Secondly, if you have, for some clue, and probably 50 Armenians in Turkey, how is it possible to make the tagging
So in the first case, Pleiades definitely does not, and that's where you would almost certainly again use Geonames, something like Pleiades Plus. Assuming that there is an association with an ancient site, you would use Pleiades Plus as a map between those two things, because there is a reasonable chance, although certainly no guarantee, that Geonames will have those alternative names as part of it. If they don't, then then they don't, and you know we're still restricted to the fact that if it's not a gazetteer, we're blind to it. There was a great example of somebody when we very first started the project. Somebody was saying, "Can you?" Very excited. "Can you tell me where Asgard is? Are you planning to find out?" And we were like, "No, we don't know."
Atlantis,
exactly. Like it's either in the gazetteers that we're working with, or it's not. And we just have to accept that that our role, effectively, the best what we can do is flag up to the gazetteer producer and say, this is something that, you know, we, these are effectively areas which can improve our process, so we can encourage them. But again, we kind of work on at a collaborative level where, you know, we neither have the expertise in the sense, nor the purpose to do more than flag these things up and sort of say, you know, can we improve it in this way? Hey, this data seems to be missing, you know, and so on. And that's, you know, for us, this what we're really excited about actually is working within that kind of ecosystem where there's these kind of positive feedback loops, rather than, you know, any given group have feeling like, well, we have to tweak this over here and go and change that thing over there, and you know, and so on. The question is, can we produce something that's A, useful and helpful for people, and secondly, continuously improving as the gazetteer improves and as the tools improve and so on. So can, do we reach that baseline where it's already helpful, and then and then which over time, if you'd like, kind of self-corrects and self-improves, I suppose.
Just a really quick thing that came back on Twitter, just to put forward, is it Matteo Romaneo?
Yeah.
He just says, makes me wonder how well they will work with my canonical citation extractor on GBooks corpus. Try.
Makes me wonder too.
Yes.
Tell him we're interested.
Yeah. And one of the it does raise an interesting question for us in terms of canonical citations, because of course, because with Hestia, the data was structured within TEI, and we were always able to. In fact, we actually had, it was great because we had an English and a Greek, an English translation in the original Greek, and we used canonical citations as a way of, and in fact, actually slightly sub-level identifiers as a way of matching those things together, so that we knew, which essentially helpfully enabled us to find interesting things about the Greek whilst using tagging that had been done in the English. So even if people are tagging a translation and not the original, with that match is quite useful. The other thing, of course, is you get, as it were, inverted commas, logical breakdowns of the text. So obviously a lot of these things are medieval, they're not, you know, they're you know, and later in terms of the traditional structure of these things. But there is some kind of sense to it. When you're using Google Books, we don't have that inverted commas luxury. So, you know, essentially,
We have to go by page numbers.
Yeah. That's, you know, and of course,
the only way we can do it.
The page numbers may change depending on the, you know, the edition or the volume or the, you know, the translation. So that does raise some interesting questions about how we tie documents together in terms of, I mean, for us, what would be great is running the same experiment over multiple versions, multiple translations, comparing the sequence of references to places, looking at that kind of thing. But, you know, there is a challenge because not only the translations differ, but how they break down page by page by page, it also varies.
Have you tried, instead of, I mean, I understand, from what I understand, you don't make a decision that is like completely certain, right? Like, you don't assign a place to a location and that's it. But have you tried maybe exposing some of that argument that you're making through the computer to the final users? Like, let's say, we are reasonably confident that this place is, you know, called this because it has been mentioned in this and this place. And but, I mean, I know you're taking into account that information, but maybe exposing it to the user.
It is something that we've given some thought to. So the way that we do this, we haven't actually kind of talked about this at all. The way we express the information is in terms of the open. So another group that we're very excited about. Are we okay for time?
Yeah.
Okay. The Open Annotation Collaboration have a very lightweight ontology for essentially annotating an online document. And that's something that we feel, again, which is really important, is about not necessarily embedding information into the text itself and saying, you know, here is the final say about where this particular thing is. It's essentially, you know, it's a series of side notes to which we can attach additional information saying, you know, who made that claim, based on what, cheers, you know, automated in what kind of way. And I've always been a fan of what you might call like kind of a traffic light system, whereby you sort of say, you know, this is highly uncertain, this is automated and untested, you know, yellow automated and tested, you know, and green, so, you know, or maybe, you know, this has been eyeballed. I think a really key thing is it's been eyeballed and somebody said, yeah, I think it's okay.
There's something similar on Perseus, isn't there, regarding, it's part of their syntax, looking at places of words within a sentence, and you're given an option as a user. You can click on any of the words in the Perseus document, if it's been TI marked up, and you can basically see whether it's, you know, a noun or what form of the noun it is or whatever. But you're not really told the right answer because it's automated, so there's no way that the computer's going to know exactly the right answer. But you're given percentages, and you can vote to say if this is, you know, if this really is a third, a feminine noun in the plural. And so you have these, you know, different options that gets to what Leif has been talking about with the eyeball, but also, I guess, certain kind of percentage values. And that I've always found quite interesting, because that's very useful as a learning tool as well. If you're learning Greek, you don't necessarily want to be told the right answer by the computer, but you want to get a sense that, you know, there's still a judgment involved, I suppose. So there's you're kind of dialoguing with the information that you have.
But that takes also the pressure from you, as like you were saying, the digital humanities is, you know, finding all the answers at some point for a computer, but it's more we're also going through an argument and we're just showing it to you now, rather than, you know, this is the right place and shut up.
Yeah, I think that's really, and that you can really see the learning potential of that, because if you're just being told stuff, you mean, you know, what are you learning there? It's when you've actually got to engage with the information, and you're presented with, I think the great thing with Percy is they present the information in such a way that really does emphasize engagement with the kind of material that they're presenting, and that I think is key for learning more generally.
I mean, one other just as a side issue to that, I think, in terms of engagement, is that we're pretty passionate about public engagement, and I think all of us on our team really feel that this has to be useful for scholars, but there has to be some kind of intuitive user friendliness for the general public in whatever way they want to use it, and we still need to kind of figure out how that might work. It raises a whole range of issues when you start talking about the general public. It's because there is no general public. There's all sorts of different kind of interest groups and so on, how that might work. But we are very interested in ways that we can kind of engage them and perhaps encourage them to, again, help in that process of correcting and improving that data. And perhaps also sort of, you know, starting to tie in outside, you know, we're already talking about classics and archaeology. No, but also thinking, say, in terms of other data sets that might be contemporary. You know, what are, for example, you know, what's going on in these places today?
A question that came in via Twitter from Joe Goldie asked, and I think this was with reference to Time Map and was it Placebook, which was, are those things online for us to play with?
Yes, I think, well, I mean...
Aren't we supposed to be giving a demonstration?
Oh, God, yes, we were supposed to be giving a demonstration. Sorry, we actually entirely forgot that.
That doesn't help her.
It doesn't help her, but it does help us in terms of remembering what the... Is it broadcast, is it streaming live?
No.
No, it's not, okay.
She was just getting it from tweets.
From tweets. You can tweet the URL if you want. So this is, for example, the narrative map of Thucydides' Peloponnesian War, so... We can use the timeline, and you can sort of see how the places kind of move through. We can click on Argos, for example, and it should give us the reference to the. Okay, so we can move the timeline here.
I'll tweet this URL.
Yes, you can. It is a work in progress, so with no guarantees about uptime or anything. But and in fact, if you have Googlebook 4, so this is Thucydides, and again, we can leaf through the actual the book itself.
Google book. Yeah.
Here we go, and that will also kind of tab us through the timeline, and we can go to the Google Book here with the URL as well, or we can jump to a particular chapter. So, you know, 1.56 might work, and that'll take us to page 56, for example, in the text itself. And if we go to a different book, so this is Google Book 3, I'm going to go to Google Book 4 for the time being, and again, oh, sorry, it's exactly the same URL. That might take us a bit of time to. One of the interesting issues is, of course, the time that it takes to load this. And so, one of the reasons we haven't advertised this as a service is that there's lots of interesting clunkiness, particularly at the beginning when it loads. Switch to the image view. So, a lot of the time, what we're finding is there weren't very many references, or we'd have a whole bunch of blank pages. And the stuff that, you know, as a user experience, it's fine because we know that it works. But if somebody else using it might well be, you know, oh. This is kind of broken, for example.
This is all stuff we knocked up before the Digital Humanities Conference, kind of a couple of days brainstorming with these guys, kind of doing a lot of fudging. So we need to get back in contact with Nick Rabinovitz, who's actually the expert on this, and so we're going to contract a few days out to him. So the functionality, I think I can safely say, will be greatly enhanced after he's had his go at it.
Yeah.
And after that point, then we can, you know, maybe making it more widely available. You can see that you can still access it now, but we just haven't disseminated it.
Right.
Oh, is your image not available? Don't know what. So yeah, mileage may vary. Pleiades as well. So we might also have here, if you went to the place book, so what's that, 472014? So this is, for example, it's not quite such a nice URL. We might have to post this somewhere. Was it 472104?
Yeah, can all this be accessed off the off the blog?
If you click through them from the blog, you should
Google
have
ancient places.
I think we have what's the
reference
to
WordPress.
Yeah, like we broke the internet. You see, that's what happens when you get above yourself. 472014.
There we go.
So that's the Sardinia Insula, and again, here's the list of all the Google references. So we can jump back to the particular the Gap book, or we can go to the specific Google book, and it tells us the number of references through the text and so on. But again, these are experimental. What we're interested in doing really is experimenting with different interfaces that allow us to approach it through the book, through the place, through the kind of combinations of those as well. It's very much until recently we were kind of worrying about getting the data out, and now we're more concerned with them.
How we can present that so it's easy for people to use and understand what they're doing. Because I think that's the key thing behind this, and is being behind some of the questions too, about being very honest and open about the kind of state of the data. So you putting the tools in the hands of the user, really. And not some techie like Leaf, but someone like me. So that I can both use the tools but also understand maybe some of the dangers or some of the limitations with them.
I thought it was terrifying, quite frankly.
Yeah, then I'll have the power.
I think this bringing in of the material culture data is really essential, because we're looking at ancient records or ancient documents, dealing with any places or locations, and some of those objects, stelae or records you mentioned on your tomb walls or whatever, are still extant in the landscape.
Yeah.
And so ideally, you would actually be linking between the mentions of those name of those places in the hieroglyphic cuneiform or whatever, where they are, linking that directly to the geography rather than via a facsimile or a surrogate back into the landscape.
And having photographs of this material as well. I know Arachne are very keen on that.
Yeah.
That's the German archaeological database, kind of the online arm of it.
Yeah.
And this really flags up to me how ignorant I am of a lot of stuff that I'm supposedly working on. I mainly do literature, I do epic, tragedy, and so places are coming up continually, and yet how much knowledge do I have of those places? And really, this is all about empowering users to be able to really extend the breadth and the depth of their research.
Plagios in particular is very much that's what the focus of that project.
Okay, I think we will wrap up the formal part in that case, and we will thank the speakers.